Several hundred evangelical leaders got together recently with Donald Trump. These are the right-wing Christian power brokers whose support used to make or break presidential candidates. Now, Donald Trump is not exactly the image of a Bible-toting, church-going family man, and that's plunged many evangelicals into a classic crisis of conscience and faith. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge, and for two decades, the evangelical movement shaped the conservative agenda and dominated the political landscape. But today, many evangelicals are having second thoughts about their political influence, and not just because of Donald Trump, but because of a foundational, never-ending tension at the heart of our democracy, the relationship between faith and politics. Is it possible for the moral values and virtues of faith to inform politics without, in turn, being corrupted by political power?
This is the problem not just evangelicals, by the way, but all religious people, that you get them close to power and their eyes, they can't see what's before them anymore. It somehow changes them.
That's Michael Gerson, and he should know. As a top aide and chief speechwriter for President George W. Bush, Gerson spent a lot of time in the Oval Office. He's considered one of the most influential evangelicals in America today, and he recently warned his fellow believers to beware the mark of Trump, which is an awfully biblical reference.
Yeah, I think it has eschatological implications. In the book of Revelation, the mark of the beast shows who owns you. You know, the mark of Trump is not the same thing, but it shows who owns evangelicals. And I think it's a very bad sign, given his views and values.
So what do you mean when you think he owns evangelicals? He's certainly not religious.
I think that evangelicals have been asked to make a deal. Trump knows he doesn't come from their background, but he's offering more favorable Supreme Court justices and to protect religious liberty. But I think evangelicals lose something in the process. They're really determining their own public character, not just a choice. And they're showing that they're focused on their own rights rather than the rights of others. They're showing that their concern for character was really just a hypocritical fraud when they called for Bill Clinton to be impeached and now are willing to accept someone of very sketchy background and character. And I think evangelicals are showing a long-term temptation to be taken in by proximity to power. The evangelical leader, Chuck Colson, who also worked in the White House, used to talk about how when he brought religious leaders into the White House, they were the most easily swayed by proximity to power. They're the most easily awed by visiting the Oval Office, by seeing the president. He compared that, for example, to union leaders who were not awed at all by such proximity.
I want to put this in some context because there was a time when the evangelical movement had a really powerful impact on American politics, and you were part of that. You know, as we said, you were one of the most acclaimed presidential speechwriters in history. You were speechwriter for George W. Bush. What was the dream? What was the big vision back when it was a new thing for evangelicals to have political power and to be shaping the country's political agenda?
I think that evangelicals, if you look at the history from the 70s, 1970s onward, with the rise of the modern religious right, a lot of it was reaction to the perceived aggressions of modernity. It was federal control of private schools. It was Roe v. Wade, which, you know, overturned laws and social conventions. And now it's the defense of religious liberty. And all of these things are defenses. They're all and defensive by nature. They're responding to perceived aggression. I think that Christians are going to need to think differently. They, instead of just responding to aggression, they're going to need to look at first principles and then apply them to current circumstances. I think the Catholic tradition, by the way, is better at doing this. They take principles like subsidiarity, the importance of private and local institutions, and solidarity. Yeah, you know, solidarity with the poor in particular, preferential option for the poor. They take these principles and apply them to issues like immigration or, you know, other matters in our public life and pro-life issues. And they come up with a more consistent ethic. So instead of just responding to perceived aggression, I think it's going to be important for Christians in this next step to apply first principles and be distinctive, be something different than just another interest group in our public life.
But it's not just the Trump phenomenon, surely. I mean, there were evangelical leaders whose names everybody in this country knows, Reverend Falwell, Pat Robertson, Ralph Reed, who preached, frankly, very intolerant messages, who said, you know, things like Hurricane Katrina was God's judgment on America because of homosexuality. That
right.
doesn't sound very compassionate.
No, I mean, certainly all along that was an argument within the movement of Christian political engagement. I think in the 70s and 80s, a lot of Christians engaged in politics went the wrong direction. They really did, you know, view themselves in almost a cynical fashion as just another interest group in the Republican Party pushing for causes that would benefit them and their members. That really has almost nothing to do with the history of Christian social engagement. And there were those cases of real excess here where Christian leaders showed that they were disconnected from the humane values of their own tradition and were discrediting. I think there's a good argument can be made that particularly among millennials, there is a serious reaction against the religious right in the number that identify themselves as nuns, as none of the above. I think one of the reasons we have so many millennials who are disengaged from institutional religion is because they saw what the religious right looked like and said, if this is religion, I don't want any part of it. And so you do have a division now, even among evangelicals, between older evangelicals who really are taking the course of the religious right, 55 and above, and 40-year-old and younger evangelicals who are very disillusioned with that type of model of social engagement, looking for something different. They have conservative social values, but they don't want to be part of a movement that is discredited in our common life because it didn't live up to its own views and values.
You know, we have a number of evangelical leaders endorsing Donald Trump, who's talked about building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico.
Right.
Would you like to see that issue framed differently?
Well, yes, absolutely. I don't think that your view of human life and dignity dictates one policy or another policy, you know, in some mechanical fashion. You have to make judgments about what good policy is. But it removes the option. I think Christian faith removes the option of dehumanizing immigrants, making them seem like the other, making them seem like a threat. That is not an option from the perspective of Christian social engagement. And that's what you're seeing on the part of a lot of Christians. It's deeply disturbing, deeply hypocritical to essentially have a politics based on us or them, a politics based on the other, criticizing the other. That is not consistent, I think, with a Christian view of what politics should be.
I mean, putting aside what does or doesn't happen with this particular election, who does or doesn't win, it sounds like evangelicals, many of them have a sense of being embattled in their own country, in their own culture, and misunderstood or rejected precisely for their faith. So I'm wondering, what would you want, say, secular liberals or secular atheists to understand about evangelicals? If there is this kind of cultural divide between, you know, people of this particular faith and, you know, the secular, modernist, none of the above folks.
I think our constitutional system is designed for disagreement. It channels it. It encompasses it. Our constitutional system is undermined, however, by mutual contempt and real hatred. And we have too much of that in our society. You know, it exists on the right and has been fed in this election cycle in a way that's quite disturbing. But it exists on the left as well in the kind of contempt for conservative religious people, which I think is real in parts of our society. It's going to require both of them to recognize that they may have different political views, different visions of public justice, but they can't view one another as fundamentally alien or subhuman or not part of the protections of our common life and our democratic experiment. You can't dehumanize your opponent. Otherwise, you get deep deep division, not just disagreement in a society. That is dangerous because we need to be united as a society to confront certain needs, and we need to show some kind of compassion and humility in our public engagement, or our systems don't work. We have great mechanisms, democratic mechanisms. But when people enter politics viewing their opponents as enemies, as subhuman, those systems don't work. So I think it's very, very important that we recover certain public virtues like civility, like a belief in the basic humanity of your opponents, and they're seeking the good from their own perspective, and a bit of epistemological humility that you don't know everything when you come to our common life. Those values are missing and necessary in our common life.
Well said. Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
Michael Gerson was the chief speechwriter for George W. Bush. Today, he's a columnist for The Washington Post and senior advisor to ONE, the nonprofit co-founded by Bono to combat extreme poverty and disease in Africa.